This is April 19th, 2015, and I'm going to tackle a massive challenge today and next week. It's a topic I've been gearing up for about 3 years, but have not done so yet because it's been so hard to get my arms around it, which is the effect on Zen practice of digital technology and social media. This is a case of fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Nonetheless, I feel compelled to do this. Two big challenges. First is the organization of it. You'll find that out soon enough. But I read two books and about a dozen articles and listened to several radio shows about this whole vast topic. I learned, especially yesterday and today, this morning, that it's very hard to get this organized in a way that is respectful of the people who are listening. I'm just going to do my best with that. And the other concern I have is just losing people who are so invested in digital technology and social media that they don't have an open mind or somehow have convinced themselves that it has so many benefits that why wouldn't you want to do it all the time? I don't know. I have no idea how many people listening to this, either people here now in the Zendo and people who are hearing it as a recording, how many people spend vast amounts of time on their digital devices and social media. But I just feel I can't be mute anymore about something that has seeped into our culture in such a basic, such an extensive way that it has to be addressed, I feel. Even though some people will say, well, this is just an old guy who hasn't really kept up with these changes. I don't care. It's the same thing I'm sure used to be said about smoking, you know, where parents would say all the reasons to stop smoking. And naturally, the smokers would just consider this just being old-fashioned and stupid and so forth. All right. And I'm going to try not to preach about this, but really to base these two teishos on causation. It's not so much a matter of what's right or wrong. We're way beyond that in how we've absorbed as a world, how we've absorbed this technology. But just to let people know what all these writers of these books I read and the articles, what they have, the conclusions they've come to, the concerns they have, and a lot of it's based on science. So that's why I say causation. You know, this cause leads to that effect, and then, of course, everyone can do what they want. I'm going to start off with a book I read actually a couple years ago and have been storing up called Hamlet's Blackberry, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. It's got a lot of good reviews. The New York Times bestseller, and just to summarize somewhat, our computer, and this is reading from the back, our computers and mobile devices do wonderful things for us, okay? And by the way, I'm going to be emphasizing the worrisome things about all these technologies. I think it's fair enough to point out what we have to be concerned about and not try to balance it with the obvious conveniences of these things and the ways that they enable us to connect even if on a superficial level. So I'm going to emphasize the things that we need to be soberly considering in order to have some balance in this. But they also impose a burden, making it harder for us to focus, do our best work, build strong relationships, and find the depth and fulfillment we crave. The author is William Powers. He goes into the past. He draws on some of history's most brilliant thinkers, from Plato to Shakespeare to Thoreau, to demonstrate that digital connectedness serves us best when it's balanced by its opposite, disconnectedness. So that's where we're going to start. And this too, maybe no one hearing this has to have this pointed out to them, but I've learned that just because you're a Zen Center member doesn't mean you sit, and sitting would be the ultimate form of disconnectedness in terms of the troublesome kind of connectedness that we have to be worried about, and it's also the ultimate form of connectedness with depth. And that's one of the author's first points, is that in all of this, what he calls digital maximalism, we're losing depth. He defines here what his phrase digital maximalism. Here's the basic premise is it's good to be connected and it's bad to be disconnected. First corollary: the more you connect, the better off you are. Second corollary, the more you disconnect, the worse off you are. This is what he's calling digital maximalism. But it comes at the price of depth. I came to the conclusion 30, 40 years ago that breadth always comes at the expense of depth. You can't have it both ways. This is just an experiential conclusion that the more broadly you spread yourself in any kind of thing, the less depth you can attain, because we only have so much time in our lives. So what'll it be? Some people will especially people with a strong need for novelty, will want to graze in more topics and more fields, and try to learn a little each about a lot of different things, but then you sacrifice depth. And he says digital busyness is the enemy of depth. And by depth he means the quality of awareness or feeling or understanding that comes from truly engaging with life experience. This begins with focus, which is what, of course, Zazen is about. We focus. Depth comes from focus. This is the other side of mindfulness. Mindfulness is more of a broad lantern kind of awareness, whereas focus is more the flashlight beam of attention. We need both. Different times require these in different mixtures, but depth comes from focus, rather than racing and skimming our way through our days. He mentions two essential benefits that are conferred by digital connectedness. And just as a little tip of the hat to these things, there's of course the convenience. People with digital devices know that they have unbelievable assets of convenience, of shopping or any number of consumer choice pursuits. And we know that through digital devices we can connect with people, but at what level is that connection happening? He talks about the gap between he says the real magic of these tools, the catalyst that transforms them from utilitarian devices into instruments of creativity, depth, and transcendence, lies in the gap that occurs between our use of them and what happens next. And he basically, to paraphrase, he sees this gap as our opportunity for reflection and contemplation. In other words, the value of these devices rests on being away from them, being disconnected. Says that the limitlessness of digital life is thrilling, but it's also unsettling. In two important ways. The first is the hours that we spend flitting constantly among tasks train us to treat our time and our attention as infinitely divisible commodities. On a screen, it's easy to jam more busyness into each moment, so that is exactly what we do. Eventually, the mind falls into a mode of thinking, a kind of nervous rhythm that's inherently about finding new stimuli, new jobs to perform. This carries over into the rest of our lives. Even when we're away from screens, it's hard for our minds to stop clicking around and come to rest. I would just insert here that I'm sure that one reason why many people don't sit very much is because of this allowing the mind to get revved up and always knowing that there are more emails and more texts, more other things that are coming in that are tugging at our attention. It's not this fear of losing something. He says the digital consciousness can't tolerate 3 minutes of pure focus. The second unsettling aspect of this is philosophical. The more we connect, the more our thoughts lean outward. There's a preoccupation with what's going on out there in the bustling other world, rather than in here with yourself and those right around you. What was once exterior and far away is now easily accessible, and this carries a sense of obligation or duty. When you can reach out and touch the whole world, a part of you guiltily feels you should be reaching out. Who is waiting to hear from me? Is the boss wondering why I haven't responded? Here, I would draw from a couple of terms that Roshi Kapil used to use, is the difference between using our minds in a centrifugal way and using our minds in a centripetal way. That our tendency, even before the first computer was invented, was to scatter our attention. That's using our mind in a centrifugal, outgoing way. And that's what digital technology has heightened immensely, is that tendency to scatter our attention. Whereas in Zen practice, in meditation generally, we're trying to balance that, not stop doing that stuff, but balance it with an ingoing, a collecting, a concentrating, centripetal use of the mind, use of our energies. And it is a balance that we need to find. He says, in addition, outwardness, that is, scattering our attention, offers something more potent than mere duty, self-affirmation, demonstrable evidence of one's existence and impact on the world. In less connected times, human beings were forced to shape their own interior sense of identity and worth, to become self-sufficient. By virtue of its interactivity, though, the digital medium is a source of constant confirmation that, yes, you do indeed exist and matter. However, this is the key thing, the external validation provided by incoming messages and the number of times one's name appears in search results is not as trustworthy or stable as the kind that comes from inside. Thus, we're forced to go back again and again for verification. Who dropped my name? Who's read my latest post? Are there any comments on my comments? Who's paying attention to me now? Just going to go sideways here for a minute and pick up on some points made by a Susan Greenfield, who is a senior research fellow at Oxford University and, by the way, a member of the House of Lords. And she's written a lot about the brain and dementia. But then from there, she went and wrote a book called Mind Change, How Digital Technologies Are Leaving Their Mark on Our Brains. And she distinguishes between digital natives and digital immigrants. Probably the majority of us are digital immigrants, and the digital natives are younger, and someday everyone will be digital natives. That is, they're indigenous to the digital world. They're born into the digital world. But for those of us who are digital immigrants, we've come to email and the internet and all as adults. She says, as kids, we drove the narrative in our games. We drove the narrative without any input, just our imagination. We were in control. There was no secondhand imagination concocted by a manufacturer. And this, she argues convincingly, gives us a kind of a sense of identity, something inside us that where there is a firewall of sorts between this thing inside you and the outside. Now here I have to point out that she's talking about can sound very much like the ego, a sense of self. But as children, we need that. We need to develop a sense of who we are. Children who don't develop that are seriously damaged emotionally. They end up in hospitals, mental institutions. So there's something healthy about developing this sense of identity. We have to develop that before we can transcend it, which is the work of Zen practice. We have to start with a core of a sense of who we are before then we can go beyond that to see that this true self is no self. And she argues that when your play as a child, if your play is with video games and other things where you don't have to make things up, you're not the driver of the narrative, then you may be growing up with a real deficit, a real lack of a sense of who you are, which of course then is bound to make such kids more vulnerable. With video games and other forms of acquiring a kind of faux sense of self, our identity is constructed externally, and it's subject to the caprices of input based on liking and disliking on an almost moment-to-moment basis. I'm quoting her here. where you need reassurance and feedback all the time from hundreds of people. And this, in turn, makes you feel more fragile with lower self-esteem. There's going to be a lot more about that later today or next week. She also points out what many others have pointed out, that that digital technology contributes to a dumbing down of emotional intelligence. She cites a study by a researcher by the name of Uhls, U-H-L-S, of Boy Scouts at summer camp where digital devices were confiscated, and these scouts showed a growth of interpersonal skills within 5 days. That's the hopeful thing about all of this, is the plasticity of the brain. She argues very strongly that the brain does have the capacity to adapt in a very short period of time. So things are never, no one is ever a lost cause. We can, by changing our habits and loosening our attachment to our digital devices, we already will be, in short time, will be noticing changes. She talks about the how digital technology takes away practice time for developing interpersonal skills. This, again, this is childhood. Learning to read others through eye contact and body language and touch. These are all skills we have to learn. This is, as she talks about, what a how much value there is in reading to your child. No doubt many Sangha parents already know this, but it gives them, by having funny voices when you're reading to them, they are introduced to different kinds of characters. Stimulates their imagination, and also in reading, usually cuddling the child. Even I know that as an uncle of lots of nieces and nephews, of having done some of that here for my sisters and babysitting. So practice time, this is what kids lose when they're involved in this, what she describes as largely a two-dimensional world of sights and sight and sound with digital devices, with video games and other such technology. They're not, their bodies are not involved in the same way. Just to stick with this a bit longer, children and video games, there's a loss of attention. There is exposure to low-grade aggression that research shows plays out. There's a desensitization to violence and increased arousal. And this is, relates to a link between the release of dopamine and underactive prefrontal functioning, which leads to a reckless desire to live in the here and now, which then can show up eventually as in obesity, gambling, and even schizophrenia. She talks about an infantilization of emotions, reacting immediately out of a particular emotion without thinking it through or considering the consequences. And this relates to the underactivity in the prefrontal cortex and its functioning, which controls emotional regulation, judgment, and decision making. These things all become compromised, these functions, become compromised through the release of dopamine that comes from video games. Addiction, another effect that's showing up in the research of children who watch video games or play with too many of them, I guess. And risk-taking, just mentioned risk-taking, the reckless desire to live in the here and now and not being concerned about the consequences. Well, that's easy enough to understand if there are no real consequences except on the screen. Her overall point is that our environment, what we're exposed to through people and video games and the internet, that these leave a mark on our brain. And being exposed to aggression will have that effect on the brain. I know that there have been some studies, or a study, I don't know, that suggests that there is no such link, but I just can't buy that. I think that over time, I expect to see more confirmation that by exposing ourselves to violence, we've become desensitized to it, and that has really very worrisome effects. Just before I leave, Susan Greenfield, she suggests three things parents can do for their kids. All right, read a story. I mentioned that. And it involves cuddling them, encouraging longer attention span in them, exposing them to different imaginary characters. A second thing parents can do is eating together. I don't think anyone listening to this needs to have that explained, the value of gathering and eating together. And then the third is physical exercise. Have your kids get back to physical exercise. And this even has the children experiencing real-life consequences, that is, as compared to screen consequences of losing a game or something like that. Like falling out of a tree. You climb a tree, you fall out, there you are. That's in the body, that consequence. Now back to Hamlet's Blackberry. So there's this gap, he says, that it's so important, the gap between ourselves and the screen. And this gap opens up when we turn it off, turn off the device. And there can be no richer gap than sitting. It doesn't have to be sitting. It could be the gap that we make when we detach from thoughts as we're driving, or as we're mowing the lawn, or as we're taking the trash out, as we're brushing our teeth. These are all opportunities for gaps that can open up this source of reflection, contemplation. It's where we give, we allow the brain to settle into its default mechanism. There's an article in Newsweek by their science writer Sharon Begley called "The Hidden Brain: What Scientists Can Learn from Nothing." She says, just to mention a few points, she says it turns out that when someone is just lying still and the mind is blank, neurons are chattering away like Twitter addicts. This they call the brain's default activity. Just to read a paragraph here, the brain is in default mode when we stare into space, sleep, succumb to anesthesia, make our mind a blank while sitting motionless. In short, when the brain's only task seems to be keeping us alive and breathing. This default activity, to everyone's surprise, is no mere murmur in the background of a loud symphony. It is the symphony, consuming 20 times as much energy as the conscious life of the mind, including thinking, feeling, and using our senses. The mental acts captured by the brain imaging, These last three are the mental acts captured by the brain imaging that so entrances the public. And then she quotes a neuroscientist, Alvaro Pascual León of Harvard, "The brain at rest is not at rest. Even more important, this resting activity is not random, but is well organized and constitutes the bulk of the brain's activity." Another neuroscientist compares the default activity to a conductor's baton, keeping distinct brain circuits, instruments, always checking in with each other and, in particular, with stored memories. The default mode is active when you are not taking in and processing information from the outside world. There it is. And no doubt, this mindfulness craze is some kind of a corrective to this mindless involvement with superficial processing and absorption of emails and texts and everything else. Talks about three areas of problems that turn up from excessive use of technology. The three are problems in the interior lives of individuals, where experts describe psychological and emotional disturbances far more serious than what I'd experienced, he says. Problem in, as a second one, a problem in family and personal relationships, where screen time has been replacing FaceTime. Again, I bet every single one of you have heard about this, read about this, but I still feel obliged to emphasize this. I think we all can hear things and read about them, but it doesn't change our behavior necessarily. And then his third one, which I'm going to skip, is just problems in businesses and other organizations where distracted workers are hurting the bottom line. Don't have time to get into that. But the first one, attention deficit problems, what he calls continuous partial attention to things. There's also what's come to be known as internet addiction disorder. And he says at the comic end of the spectrum, nomophobia, which is the fear of being out of mobile phone contact. The impact on personal and family relationships as screen time rises, direct human-to-human interaction falls off proportionally. He coined a phrase, the vanishing family trick, where he describes a scenario where he's in the living room with his two kids and his wife, and then somebody excuses themselves for a bathroom visit or a glass of water and doesn't return. 5 minutes later, another of us exits on a similarly mundane excuse, along the lines of, I have to check something. The third, now alone, soon follows, leaving just the animals, who, if they can think about such things, must be wondering what suddenly became of a splendid gathering they had barely gotten underway. Where have all the humans gone? He confesses that he reads most of the emails he receives in a kind of a rushing way. He says the point is almost not to be thoughtful, not to pause and reflect, to eliminate the gaps. He talks about the rushed, careless quality of screen communication, and it's how it's a piece with the discounting of physical togetherness. When everyone is endlessly available, all forms of human contacts begin to seem less special and significant. Little by little, companionship itself becomes a commodity, cheap, easily taken for granted. A person is just another person, and there's so many of those, blah, blah, blah. Why not flee the few of the living room for the many of the screen, where all relationships are flattened into one user-friendly mosaic, a human collage that's endlessly clickable and never demands your full attention? He said, I sometimes felt as if love itself, or the acts of heart and mind that constitute love, were being leached out of the house by our screens. He talks about nature deficit disorder. We spend so much time of the day huddled with screens that we're barely aware of the third dimension. And then he cites a couple of examples, one of which is a headline, a true headline: teen girl falls in open manhole while texting. And a more tragic one is just here locally. Earlier this year in the winter, young man was walking along railroad tracks with his earbuds in, listening to who knows what, and was killed by a train that he couldn't hear. This was someone who at least one of our Sangha members knew in high school. Came as quite a shock. This is the sight that slays me more than any other. See people, usually young people, walking on the sidewalk with their earbuds in, sealed off from their surroundings. It's understandable why someone would do that, to be able to have your preference for whatever kind of music or other programming you want. It's even understandable for people who are don't want to have to deal with other people, strangers, is to create this bubble of isolation and their safe, protected world of their choosing. But it's just appalling from the point of view of Zen practice to cut yourself off from your surroundings. And any possibility, or almost any possibility, of human interaction. It's a signal. When I see someone like that, I might want to say something about the weather or engage them somehow, but that is off limits when you see someone with their earbuds in, their eyes down. Here's a phrase that I scribbled down: this tendency in this digital world of to be away from the few and the near toward the many and the far. And just one bit about that drop in business organizational productivity and effectiveness. He says it's the very way screens allow us to shift rapidly among tasks that winds up slowing down our execution of the tasks themselves due to the recovery problem. This is something I bet some of you have heard about. It's just you interrupt your work to check an email or receive or send a text, and then there's a recovery period where you're not really with what you're doing. It takes a while to get back to what you're doing. And he cites what I've read, an article or two I read about a desire for a reprieve, a break from the digital crowd. In that article that I read by a Caroline Tell, the name of the article is Step Away from the Phone. And it's about efforts to reclaim privacy, which is another loss with this world of excessive connectedness digitally, is a loss of privacy. She talks about the phone stack game, where when guests arrive for dinner or some gathering, they all have to relinquish their cell phone or smartphone, and the first person who checks their cell phone, they put it all in the center of the table, and the first person who checks it has to pay some price or something. And how, in this article, she talks about these weaning techniques. No iPods at the dinner table. A digital curfew, turning off devices by 11 o'clock at night. Cell phone lock boxes, where you come in, even in your own house, you recognize the temptation of checking your phone. You put them in some kind of a box. Unplugging at dinner time, unplugging while playing with your kids. This is something that is also so sad, is parents who are walking their kids on the street, on the sidewalk, and they're just lost in their smartphone, ignoring the kid. Back to the default network. Another article, a New York Times article by Matt Richtel, is called Digital Devices Deprive the Brain of Needed Downtime. He acknowledges that cell phones let people relieve the tedium of exercising, the tedium of the grocery line, tedium of stoplights, the tedium of lulls in dinner conversation. But, as a side effect, forfeiting this downtime when we have nothing to do this downtime is what allows us to better learn and remember information. It's not just, as another writer said, just drinking from a fire hose of information, but it's then being able to process it, learn, remember, interpret. I recently heard a rebroadcast of an interview of Mario Cuomo from 20 years ago. And in it, he makes this point, I think, is really very insightful, that we all are exposed to so much information, but where do we hear the interpreting of it based on wisdom? If information isn't knowledge, then it certainly isn't wisdom. It's the downtime that enables us to interpret and understand information, all this information we're exposed to. He makes the point that even though people feel entertained or even relaxed when they multitask while exercising, or pass a moment at a bus stop by catching a quick video clip, they might be taxing their brains. And Mark Berman, a neuroscientist at University of Michigan, says they think they're refreshing themselves, but they're fatiguing themselves. In another article, a Newsweek article by same science writer we just were reading from, Sharon Begley, this article is called "I Can't Think," and this is info paralysis or information fatigue. And this is the science behind it. Some information that we take in increases the activity in our prefrontal cortex. Remember that the prefrontal cortex is what controls decision-making, judgment, and the control of emotions. So some information enhances those functions, but too much, they have found, compromises judgment, decision-making, and control of emotions, and leads to poor choices. It also, when we allow ourselves to be exposed to too much information in making choices, there's all kinds of research that shows that we make poorer choices. And she suggests that there is an unconscious system guiding many of our decisions that that can be sidelined by too much information. Decisions that requiring creativity benefit from letting the problem incubate below the level of awareness. Again, zazen. There's all this fascinating research about trying to make the perfect decision, say with consumer goods, a coffee maker, or running gear or something, that the more information we try to assimilate, the more we tend to regret the many other options. That is, the less satisfied we are. Even when they find an objective way of determining that it was the best decision, there still is the feeling of dissatisfaction the more information we try to assimilate in making a decision. More about decision making. This is from an article again in Newsweek. This is the same article. Sorry, I Can't Think. It's called, and I just wanted to read some of this from here. This is by Sharon Begley, science writer. We are conditioned to give greater weight in our decision making machinery to what is latest, not what is more important or more interesting. They call this a powerful recency effect in decision making. And then this: creative decisions are more likely to bubble up from a brain that applies unconscious thought to a problem, zazen, rather than going at it in a full frontal analytical assault. So while we're likely to think creative thoughts in the shower, it's much harder if we're under a virtual deluge of data. And then someone here quotes, I won't try to go back and figure out his name, who he is, Cantor. If you let things come at you all the time, you can't use additional information to make a creative leap or a wise judgment. You need to pull back from the constant influx and take a break. Actually, a confession. I've been so deluged with these books and articles in the last 48 hours and so concerned about making this an organizational mess in the Teisho. But nonetheless, I've learned through long experience that I have to get away from it. So I not only got a decent night's sleep, but the first thing I did this morning, and the first thing I do every morning, is zazen. I've learned that you need that downtime. You need to get underneath the surface into some stillness in order to consolidate, to make sense of all of this. And then she says, that allows the brain to subconsciously integrate new information with existing knowledge and thereby make novel connections and see hidden patterns. In contrast, a constant focus on the new makes it harder for information to percolate just below conscious awareness, where it can combine in ways that spark smart decisions. I have many, many years I've been talking about the benefit of one of the benefits of Zazen as enabling us to get a fresh perspective on a problem or a decision, a career decision, an ethical decision. I think in Taisho I've talked about how when I get tangled up when I'm writing an article, I find that if I just walk away from the table and cross my legs, even 10 minutes will clarify things. Anyone, I think, could confirm this through their own sitting. She continues, one of the greatest surprises in decision science is the discovery that some of our best decisions are made through unconscious processes. When subjects in one study evaluated what so-and-so calls a rather daunting amount of information about four hypothetical apartments for rent, size, location, friendliness of the landlord, price, and eight other features, those who decided unconsciously which to rent did better. The scientists made sure the decision was unconscious by having the subjects do a memory and attention task. 1, 2, 3. There it is, which tied up their brains enough that they couldn't contemplate, say, square footage. I remember Roshi Kapil saying this decades ago, that in counting the breath or following the breath, we're giving the brain a break, tying it up with this simple attention task to allow deeper resources to prevail, to come up to consciousness. And then just some specific advice, recommendations. How can you protect yourself from having your decisions warped by excess information? Experts advise dealing with emails and texts in batches rather than in real time. That should let your unconscious decision-making system kick in. Avoid the trap of thinking that it is a decision requiring you to assess a lot of complex information is best made methodically and consciously. You will do better and regret less if you let your unconscious turn it over by removing yourself from the info influx. Set priorities. If a choice turns on only a few criteria, focus consciously on those. Some people are better than others at ignoring extra information. These sufficers, as she calls them, are able to say enough. They channel surf until they find an acceptable show and then stop. Whereas maximizers never stop surfing, devouring information, and so struggle to make a decision and move on. If you think you're a maximizer, the best prescription for you might be the off switch on your smartphone. All right, we've come to the end of our time for today. A week from today, I'm going to tackle the very broad topic of social media, more specifically Facebook and the Twitter world. And again, citing experts like Sherry Turkle, who wrote this marvelous book, Alone Together, which I could recommend to everyone, for no other reason than to be able to appreciate what young people are up against in terms of anxiety by living in social media. And we'll stop now and recite the four vows.